Anglo-Saxon missionaries to Germany, they had received the support from Charles Martel, the founder of the Carolingian dynasty in the European region of Gaul, later to be known, of course, as France. Now, Martel supported these missions because of his desire to expand his rule eastward into the German region of Bavaria. The Pope was grateful for his support and for Charles's victory over the Muslims at the Battle of Tours in 732. But Martel fell afoul of papal favor when he confiscated church lands. At first, the church consented to his seizing of property to produce income to stave off the Muslim threat. But once that threat was dealt with, he refused to return the lands. Adding insult to injury, Martel ignored the Pope's request for help against the Lombards who'd taken control of a good chunk of Italy. Martel denied assistance because at the time, the Lombards were his allies. But a new era began with the reign of Martel's heir, Pippin III. Pippin was raised in the monastery of Saint-Denis near Paris. He and his brother were helped by the church leader Boniface to carry out a major reform of the Frank Church. These reforms of the clergy and the church organization brought about a renewal of religious and intellectual life and made possible the educational revival associated with the greatest of the Carolingian rulers, Charlemagne, and his Renaissance that we covered in the last episode. In 751, Pepin persuaded Pope Zachary to allow Boniface to anoint him as the king of the Franks, officially supplanting the Merovingian dynasty. Then, another milestone in church-state relations passed with Pope Stephen II appealing to Pepin for aid against the Lombards. The Pope placed Rome under the protection of Pepin and recognized him and his sons as protectors of the Romans. Now, as we've recently seen, all of this church-state alliance came to a focal point with the crowning of Charlemagne as the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire in AD 800. For some time, the popes in Rome had been, they'd been looking for a way to loosen their dependence on Constantinople and the Eastern emperors. Religious developments in the East provided the popes an opportunity to finally break free. The iconoclast controversy dominating Eastern affairs gave Western popes one more thing to express their disaffection with. And we're going to take a closer look at that dust-up later. For now, it's enough to say that the Eastern emperor Leo III banned the use of icons as images of religious devotion in 726. Supporters of icons ultimately prevailed, but only after a century of very bitter and at times violent dispute. Pope Gregory II rejected Leo's edict banning icons and flaunted his disrespect for the emperor's authority. Gregory's pompous and scathing letter to the emperor was long on bluff, but a dramatic statement of his rejection of secular rulers meddling in church affairs. Pope Gregory wrote, quote, "Listen, dogmas are not the business of emperors, but of pontiffs," unquote. Well, the reign of what was regarded by the West as a heretical dynasty gave the Pope the excuse that he needed to separate from the East and find a new, devoted, and orthodox protector. The alliance between the papacy and the Carolingians represents the culmination of that quest and opened a new and momentous chapter in the history of medieval Christianity. In response to the Pope's appeal for help against the Lombards, Pepin recovered the church's territories in Italy and gave them to the Pope, an action known as the Donation of Pepin. This confirmed the legal status of what came to be known as the Papal States. At about the same time, the Pope's claim to the rule of Italy and independence from the Eastern Roman Empire, it was reinforced by the appearance of one of the great forgeries of the Middle Ages, known as the Donation of Constantine. Now, this spurious document claimed that Constantine the Great had given Rome and the western part of the empire to the Bishop of Rome when he moved the capital of the empire to the east. The donation was not exposed as a forgery until the 15th century. The concluding act in the Pope's attempts to free themselves from Constantinople, that came on Christmas Day of 800 when Pope Leo III revived the empire in the west by crowning Charlemagne as the Holy Roman Emperor. It's rather humorous. As one wag put it, the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman and can scarcely be called an empire. Charlemagne's chief scholar was the British-born Alcuin, who'd been a master of a cathedral school in York. He was courted by Charlemagne to make his capital in Aachen on the border between France and Germany, Europe's new center of education and scholarship. Alcuin did just that. If the school at Aachen didn't outright plant the seeds that would later flower in the Renaissance, it certainly prepared the soil for them. Alcuin profoundly influenced the intellectual, cultural, and religious direction of the Carolingian Empire, as the 300-plus letters that he wrote make clear. His influence is best seen in the manuscripts of the school at Tours, where he later became abbot. His influence is also demonstrated in his educational writings, his revision of the biblical text, commentaries, and the completion of his version of church liturgy. He standardized spelling, writing, reformed missionary practices, and contributed to the organizing of church regulations. Alcuin was the leading theologian in the struggle against the heresy of what's known as adoptionism. Now, adoptionists said that Jesus was simply a human being that God had adopted and made a son. Alcuin was a staunch defender of Christian orthodoxy and the authority of the church, the preeminence of the Roman bishop, and of Charlemagne's sacred position as emperor. Alcuin died in 804. The time at which Alcuin lived certainly needed the reforms that he brought, and I have to say he was the perfect agent to bring them. From the palace school there at Aachen, a generation of his students went out to head monastic and cathedral schools throughout Europe. Though Charlemagne's empire, it barely outlived its founder, the revival of education and religion that was associated with Alcuin, that brightened European culture throughout the bleak and chaotic period that followed. This Carolingian Renaissance turned to classical antiquity and early Christianity for its models. The problem is there was only one Western scholar who still knew Greek, the Irishman John Scotus Erigena. Still, the manuscripts produced during this era form the base from which modern historians gain a picture of the past. It was these classical texts, translated from Greek into Latin, that fueled the later European Renaissance. The intellectual vigor stimulated by the Carolingian Renaissance and the political dynamism of the revived empire stimulated new theological activity. There was discussion about the continuing iconoclast controversy in the East. Political antagonism between the Eastern and Western emperors led to an attack by theologians in the West on the practices and beliefs of the Orthodox Church in the East. These controversial works on what were called the errors of the Greeks flourished during the 9th century as the result of the Phocian Schism. In 858, Byzantine Emperor Michael III deposed the Patriarch Ignatius I of Constantinople, replacing him with a lay scholar named Phocius I, also known as Phocius the Great. The now deposed Ignatius appealed to the Western Pope, Nicholas I, to restore him, while Phocius asked the Pope to recognize his appointment. Well, the Pope ordered the restoration of Ignatius, and relations between East and West sunk further. The issue ended in 867 when Pope Nicholas died and Phocius was deposed. Western Latin theologians criticized the Eastern Church for its different method of deciding the date of Easter, the difference in the way the clergy cut their hair, and the celibacy of priests. The Eastern Church allowed priests to marry while requiring monks to be celibate, whereas, of course, in the Western Church, celibacy was required for both. Another major doctrinal debate was called the Filioque controversy. We briefly touched on in an earlier episode. There's a debate over the pronunciation of filioque. Some say filioque, others filioque. Take your pick. The point is, the controversy dealt with the wording of the Nicene Creed as related to the Holy Spirit. Remember that the original creed said that the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father, period, full stop. A bit later, the Western Church altered the wording a bit so as to affirm the equality of the Son of God with the Father. They said that the Spirit proceeded from both Father and Son. Filioque is Latin for "and the Son," thus providing the name of the controversy. The Eastern Church saw this addition as dangerous tampering with the original Nicene Creed that the Church had struggled so long and hard to nail down. They refused to accept the what they considered dangerous edit, while the Filioque clause became a standard part of what was considered Orthodox doctrine in the West. Another major discussion arose over the question of predestination. A Carolingian monk named Gottschalk, who had studied Augustine's theology very carefully, was the first to teach double predestination. That is the belief that some people are predestined to salvation while the rest are predestined to damnation. He was tried and found condemned for his views by two synods and finally imprisoned by the Archbishop of Reims. Gottschalk died 20 years later, holding his views to the end. The other major theological issue of the Carolingian era concerned the Lord's Supper. The influential abbot of Corby wrote a treatise titled On the Body and Blood of the Lord. This was the first clear statement of a doctrine of the real presence of Christ's body and blood in the communion elements, later called the doctrine of transubstantiation, an issue that will become a heated point in the debate between the Roman Church and the Reformers. Now, the reforms of King Pepin and Pope Boniface, they focused attention on the behavior of priests. You see, it was clear to all that clergy ought to lead lives beyond reproach. That synod after synod during the 6th through the 8th centuries had to make such a major issue of this demonstrated the need for reform. Among the violations warned against were the rejection of celibacy, gluttony, drunkenness, tawdry relationships with women, hunting, carrying arms, and frequenting taverns. Monastic developments at this time were significant. The emphasis was on standardization and centralization. Between 813 and 17, a revised Benedictine rule was adopted for the whole of the Carolingian Empire. Another Benedict, this time a monk from Burgundy, was responsible for an ultra-strict regimen. Charlemagne's successor, Louis the Pious, appointed Benedict as the overseer of all monasteries in his realm. And a few years later, his revised Benedictine rule was made obligatory for all monasteries, sadly, with little long-term effect. When Louis succeeded Charlemagne, the Pope was able to regain his independence following a long domination by the emperor. The imperial theocracy of Charlemagne's reign would have yielded a state church, as already existed in the East. But the papacy stressed the superiority of spiritual power over the secular. This was reinforced by the forged Donation of Constantine, with its emphasis on papal preeminence and the governing of the empire, not just the church. In the middle of the 9th century, priests at Reims produced another remarkable forgery. It was called the False Decretals. Accomplished with great inventiveness, the Decretals were designed to provide a basis in law that protected the rights of bishops. They included the bogus Donation of Constantine and became a central part of the canon of medieval law. It shored up papal claims of supremacy in church affairs over secular authorities. The first pope to make use of the False Decretals was Nicholas I. He recognized the danger of a church dominated by civil rulers, and he was determined to avert this by stressing the church's government was centered on Rome, not on Constantinople, and certainly not in some lesser city like, you know, Milan or Ravenna, where the capital of the Western Empire had moved. From the late 9th until the middle 11th century, Western Christendom was beset by a host of major challenges that left the region vulnerable. The Carolingian Empire was fragmented, leaving no major military power to defend Western Europe. Continued attacks by Muslims in the south, a fresh wave of attacks by the Magyars in the east, and incessant raids by the Norsemen all over the place, well, it turned the shards of the empire into splinters. One contemporary lamented, quote, "Once we had a king, now we have kinglets," unquote. For many Western Europeans, it seemed that the end of the world was at hand. The Pope no longer had Carolingian rulers as protectors, and so the papacy became increasingly involved in the power struggles among the Italian nobility. Popes became partisans of one political faction or another, sometimes willingly, other times coerced. The cumulative result was spiritual and moral decline. For instance, Pope Stephen VI, he took vengeance on the preceding pope by having his body disinterred from the grave, brought before a synod, where it was propped up in a chair for trial. Following its conviction, the body was thrown into the Tiber River. And then, within a year, Stephen himself was overthrown and strangled while in prison. There was a near-complete collapse of civil order in Europe during the 10th century. Church property was ransacked by invaders or fell to the hands of the nobility. Noblemen treated churches and monasteries as their private property to dispose of as they wished. The clergy became indifferent to their duties. Illiteracy and immorality among the clergy grew. The 10th century was a genuine dark age, at least as far as the condition of the church was concerned. Without imperial protection, popes became helpless playthings for the nobility, who fought to gain control by appointing relatives and political favorites. A chronicle by the German Bishop of Cremona paints a graphic picture of the sexual debauchery in the church at that time. Though there were incompetent and immoral popes during this period, they continued to be respected throughout the West. Bishoprics and abbeys were founded by laymen after they obtained the approval of the papal court. Pilgrimages to Rome hardly slackened as Christians visited the sacred sites of the West. The tombs of Peter and Paul, as well as a host of others, were venerated objects. At the lowest ebb of the 10th century, during the reign of Pope John XII, from 955 to 64, a major change in Italian politics affected the papacy. An independent and capable German monarchy emerged. This Saxon dynasty began with the election of Henry I and continued with his son, Otto I, also known as Otto the Great. Now, Otto developed a close relationship with the German church. Bishops and abbots were given the rights and honor of high nobility. The church received huge tracts of land. Through this alliance, Otto aimed to forestall the rebellious nobles of his kingdom. But the new spiritual aristocracy created by Otto, that wasn't hereditary. You know, bishops and abbots couldn't pass on their privileges to their successors. Favor was granted by the king to whomever he chose. Thus, their loyalty could be counted on more readily. In fact, the German bishops contributed money and arms to help German kings expand their territory, what is now the regions of East Germany and Poland. Otto helped raise the papacy out of the quagmire of Italian politics. His entrance into Italian affairs was a fateful decision. He marched south into Italy to marry Adelaide of Burgundy and declare himself King of the Lombards. 10 years later, he again marched south at the invitation of Pope John XII. In February of 962, the Pope tried a renewal of the Holy Roman Empire by crowning Otto and Adelaide there in St. Peter's. But the price paid by the Pope for Otto's support was another round of interference in church affairs. For the next 300 years, each new German monarch followed up his election by making a march to Rome to be crowned as emperor. But at this point, it wasn't so much popes who made emperors as it was emperors who made popes. And when a pope ran afoul of the ruler, he was conveniently labeled anti-pope and deposed to be replaced by the next guy. It was the age of musical chairs in Rome. You know, whoever grabs the papal chair when the music stops gets to sit. But when the emperor strikes up the band, whoever is in the chair has to stand, and the game, well, it starts all over again. Unless you think I'm overstating the case, in 963, Otto returned to Rome, convened a synod that found Pope John guilty of a list of sordid crimes, and deposed him. In his place, they chose a layman who received all of his ecclesiastical orders in a single day to become Pope Leo VIII. He managed to sit in the Pope's chair less than a year before the music started all over again.